In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all our steps on the path to omniscience, may these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. I thought class was over, right? We were going to do the Shambhala chant. Hey, good evening and welcome. Imagine, like, this is just incredible. We're here in the middle of who knows where, some odd building, gathered together to study valid cognition. It's bizarre, isn't it? It's sort of cool, though. So, let's see, does anybody need a hard copy of the syllabus, some outline? Anybody? Good. Any other? You good? And let's see. Okay, so I have all sorts of handouts for tonight, but we'll go through. Tonight we start with the text. Did you guys peruse your books? You're still looking for one.
It's on the way. Mine's on the way.
Okay, you ordered it.
We didn't use it last week.
Yeah, we did.
We did. We'd use the root text. We dove in. And, just in case you didn't notice, there's some interesting stuff towards the back of the book, which is, for those of you that don't have the book.
And they did it in the introduction.
There is on page Appendix A, 191, there's Meepom's annotated version of the story of the root verses. So this interesting little type of document where a teacher takes their own root text, and it's like not really, it's like a mini commentary or something, just sort of like little glosses on the root text. And so he gives some little filling in. And maybe, you know, what we've done in prior courses is, as we go through the commentary, maybe we could read the root verses that we're going on, working on that night, as together as a group. Maybe we can use this annotated version to do that, as that for some way of weaving in the root text. So let's see, we're working on the translate. Let's see, we're going through page, the two truths. Now I need the outline. Does the outline show the verse numbers? Yes. So, okay. So we're going through verse number 4 all the way. Is that right? Not even going through verse 3. Well, the way this translator chopped up the verses, but
Page 19 through 42?
42, yeah. Okay, so it's the first three verses. Well, we'll get a taste for what that annotated version is in the back.
Are we reading all of it or just...
Yeah, let's read all of it. Maybe the stuff that's not bold, you could read in as if it's italics.
What page do you want?
Page 191. The sort of wisdom that ascertains reality. So
So let's all read together the first three and then the comment on the bottom. How about the this philosophy, the teachings, valid scriptures, is unmistaken. All errors have been eliminated. The teacher, valid direct perception. The mind is free from doubt about the three. Through fulfilling the three criteria for valid evidence points, the method of proof is valid inference. I pay homage to Manjushri because he is the essence of all these, the treasure of wisdom. The Mahayana teachings of the Sugata are profound. Emptiness, the absolute, vast, such as the bhumis and paramitas, the relative, and difficult to realize. For those fortunate ones who wish to taste this deathless nectar, I will bestow the light of excellent explanations which give rise to intelligence. The Dharma, in its multiplicity, taught by the Buddhas, is completely based on the two truths. The entire subject matter, what are these? The worldly, relative truth, and the supreme, absolute truth that transcends the world. It should be understood that it is impossible to have any higher realization than the realization of the nature of the two truths, just as it is. As one progresses through the jhanas, one realizes more and more profoundly how the two truths are the very nature of things. So it's all about the two truths, right? Reminds me of the famous summary of the entirety of Dharma into ground, path, and fruition. Where the ground is what?
Suffering.
In the Mahayana tradition. Say again?
Emptiness.
Emptiness. So those two things, right? Suffering and emptiness, the two truths. The ground is the two truths. The path is what? Everything's in twos. It's the three twos. So that's a hint. So what's the path to what encompasses? The two accumulations, right, of what? Of merit and wisdom. And then the fruition is the two what?
Kayas.
The two kayas, yeah.
Yeah, oh, because it's
what are the two kayas?
The Dharmakaya and Rupakaya.
Dharmakaya and Rupakaya, right? What's the Rupakaya consist of? Cool. So what's the connection between the two accumulations and the two kayas?
The accumulation of wisdom corresponds to the Dharmakaya.
In what way?
In that wisdom pertains to the nature of ultimate reality, which is the Dharmakaya.
That wisdom pertains to it. Is there a cause and effect relationship?
No. Yes? I don't know. Is there?
That was definitive.
Generally,
how
can
cause and effect exist within the ultimate?
How can cause and effect? You have ultimate cause and effect.
So, what was our question again? What's the relationship between
the accumulation of wisdom brings about the blossoming of the Dharma, the Kaya, the realization of it, as opposed to it doesn't produce it, right? And then the accumulation of merit, does the accumulation of merit produce the Rupakaya?
Dharmakaya and Sambhogakaya.
That's what it consists of, but does the accumulation of, what's the relationship between the accumulation of merit and this and the Rupakaya? Is it a causal one?
Yes.
It is, isn't it?
It is,
right?
Yeah.
And what about going back to the ground and the two truths? What's the relationship between the two truths and the two accumulations?
The relative truth is the accumulation of merit, and ultimate truth is the accumulation of wisdom.
Cool. Everyone agree on that?
Mm-hmm.
All in favor say aye. I'm supposed to repeat these things. I was asked to repeat these things. Please remind me when there's questions or comments, I need to repeat it so that it appears on the recording device. Is that okay?
That's actually great. Thank you.
Okay. So please remind me if I don't. And I will try to repeat Chris's words here, which is that basically the summation of the entirety of the Dharma from the Mahayana point of view is that there's ground, path, and fruition, and the ground is the two truths, the relative and the absolute, and the relative is worked with through the accumulation of merit on the path, and the absolute is approached through the accumulation of wisdom in the path, and the accumulation of merit over numerous infinite lifetimes, almost infinite lifetimes, brings about the rupakaya, which consists of the samogakaya and the nirmanakaya, and the cultivation of wisdom brings about the realization of the dharmakaya. The two benefits. What are the two benefits? The benefit for
self and other.
Self and other. So that's another way of describing the two kayas. Of the two kayas, which is the benefit for oneself?
The dharmakaya.
The dharmakaya is the benefit for oneself. Therefore, the benefit for others is
rupakaya.
Okay. So, hey, the reading for tonight included going through the homage, various homages, which, you know, on the one hand, I think you could spend a very long time going into all the very interesting details of the legendary mythology that is referenced in the homages. But I think we'd be better served by spending more time on the content. So I'm going to try to go through those quickly, and then we'll spend a little bit more time on the content in the second chapter and the handouts that I have. So starting on page 19 of the text, you have the homage to Manjushri and Padmasambhava in union. Now, those are two guys, if that applies, so I don't know if that struck anyone as unusual, but if it did, you're clearly not up to date.
In gender fluidity.
You're totally uptight. Get over it. Namo Shri Vajra Padma Tikshnaya. Homage to the glorious and sharp Vajra Lotus. Sharp. Wow. Okay. Glorious and sharp. Homage to Shakyamuni Buddha with the chariot of the winds of the two accumulations. You led the four divisions of the troops. Did you guys? There's lots of notes, right? And they're pretty arcane. Maybe somebody can look at the notes while I go through the text. How about you, Brent? You check out the notes for me and I can ask you to repeat the notes. Is that a yes?
Yeah.
Thanks. So what are the four divisions of the troops?
Elephants.
Tigers and lions and bears?
Elephants and...
Elephants, horses, chariots, and foot soldiers.
Right, the traditional four divisions of an army, right?
Huh.
You thought it was going to be some Dharmic thing, right? Totally just from Indian lore. What was it again? Elephants, horses, chariots, and men?
Foot soldiers.
Okay. What are these days, the four divisions of an army are? The
Air,
Navy,
Air Force, Marines.
Marines,
Navy, Air Force, Marines.
Army.
Jeez. Okay. Moving right along. The Ten Powers. Anything good on the Ten Powers? What are these? Not what are the ten, but what are they generally? What are not specifically?
Types of knowledge unique to a Buddha.
Okay, a big list. Types of knowledge, thank you. The ten are types of knowledge unique to a Buddha. So you lead them to victory in battle over the gods of desire. And the gods of desire means not gods necessarily that are desire, you know, filled with desire, as in like maybe Greek lore, where who was like a god filled with desire? That's like
Zeus.
Greek lore. Zeus, the head guy, he was like totally a lush, right? So, but instead, it's this refers to what the way that the world is structured in terms of.
Oh, the three realms.
The three realms, yes. What are the three realms? Anyone else?
Realm.
Anyone else? Barbara, Anya? The three realms. New York, San Francisco, and the rest of the world. No, L.A. the three realms. We got desire. What else? The three realms of existence.
Six.
Yeah.
Different
That's seven. Another one. The six realms. Isn't that weird? So we'll go over how they intersect, but the other of the three realms, form and formless. Okay, so three realms, form, desire, form, and formless. So the six realms are what? Starting from the bottom of samsara.
Hell.
Animal.
Hungry ghosts.
Oh. And then?
Animals.
And then?
Humans.
Us. And then?
Gods.
And then
gods.
Okay, so of those six, how many of those are exclusively in the desire realm?
Five
of them.
Oh,
right? So that leaves the sixth, meaning that the sixth is not totally encapsulated in the desire realm, but goes beyond the desire realm, is part of the desire realm, but also goes beyond it. And does it extend all the way through to the formless realms, or just the form realms? All the way through. So it spans all three realms, the gods. And so there's gods of the formless realms, gods of the form realms, and gods of the desire realms. And so this is talking about gods of the desire realms. What do the gods of the formless realms look like? It's like, what's the which
formless,
direction
yes.
does the smoke of the electric train change go? Okay, with the sharp fangs and claws, do we need to look at this? Brent, help us out. Anything good there?
Well, here the metaphor for the Buddha is a lion who can devour other animals, even elephants.
Right. So that's his fangs and claws. And of the four fearlessnesses, anything good?
Also qualities that are unique to a Buddha.
Give us, since there's only four, give us the four.
Fearlessness in proclaiming the mastery of perfect abandonment, fearlessness in proclaiming the mastery of perfect realization, fearlessness in showing the path to others, and fearlessness in revealing hindrances on the path.
What else?
That's the four.
Keep reading.
The first two refers to the enlightened being, and the last two refers to others.
Cool. Okay. Lots of little trivia tonight.
You have elephant brains.
You swallowed all at once the elephant brains. What does the elephant represent here?
Of antagonistic performance.
Ignorance.
Conceptual mind, or with the mind of Tirthikas. Who are Tirthikas?
Heathens. Non-believers.
Yes. It says here they're proponents of eternalism and nihilism.
Yeah.
Are Tirthikas. Tirthika means they go to the limits, the extremes. Yeah. The biggest animal symbolizes the greatest ignorance. Okay, let's see. Adventistic proponents of eternalism and nihilism. For nihilism, by abiding on the snow mountains, must no longer live in the snow mountains of knowing the nature and extent of all phenomena. What are those two? Nature and extent of all phenomena.
I think that's like the. What the way things are and the way they appear.
So which is the way things are?
Nature.
And the way they appear is their extent.
Myriad things.
And do those relate to some scheme we went over earlier?
Absolute relative.
Truths, right? So which one applies to which?
Absolute maybe it's the nature.
Is the nature of all phenomena, and the relative is the extent of phenomena. So those are the two aspects of omniscience of a Buddha. It's knowing the extent of the relative and the nature of all things, the absolute nature of all things. Okay, sorry, you guys know all this stuff, right? No? Yes? Through the two yogic disciplines. What are the two yogic disciplines?
Meditative equipoise and
post-meditation. Cool. Read the rest.
A realized being knows the wisdom of the true nature in meditation and knows the entire extent of phenomena in post-meditation.
Yeah, so in meditation we contact the ultimate in equipoise, samadhi, and then in post-meditation we understand the extent of the relative world. We understand the nature or how the relative world appears.
So when we talk about knowing omniscience about the relative world, does that mean like they know everything? Like don't
it's up to
enjoy,
you. Which there's various
novels.
It's up to it's. There's two. You know, there are two views on that. Or one that well, they don't know every detail of every moment and every inch of space, but they know the way that things happen. By and what's the general way that phenomena happen? In terms of knowing the extent, interdependently, right? They rise dependently, right? So they understand dependent arising. But some traditions hold that the Buddha knows everything instantly, simultaneously, everywhere.
But doesn't that kind of fly in the face of like karma being non-deterministic?
Yeah. Yeah, it sure does. That's why I vote for the former, personally. In the center of a thousand spoke wheel, among humans you are exalted like a lion. So, a thousand spoke wheel is the image of what?
Chakravartin.
The Chakravartin, which was transformed by the Buddha into the Dharma Vartin, or the Dharma Chakra, the wheel of Dharma. Instead of a weapon, it's the wheel, it's the Dharma.
Lost a bunch of spokes.
Say again?
Lost a bunch of spokes in that process.
Down to eight. You are called Siddhartha. Since you have accomplished all aims, please bring forth auspiciousness. Okay, let's speed this up. Homage to Padmasambhava, shining with a thousand luminous marks of deathlessness, you sprang forth from a lotus blossom in the center of a lake. Boom! Nongsi Zilnan, Nirmanakaya, who outshines all apparent existence, please be the crown jewel that beautifies my head until I'm fully enlightened. And then, whatever. The homage to Manjushri, on the tip of the anthers of a thousand-petaled lotus of devotion. Isn't that cool? Like, you know, big lotus, and then in the middle there must be these wild anthers, you know, sticky pollen film, right? Lord of Dharma, I continue to reverently pay homage to you, Mawe Senge. I love that sound, that word, Mawe. Every youthful line of speech.
Town in New Jersey, isn't there called Mawe?
Yes. New Jersey. Manjushri, where is he from? Southern Jersey.
His speech is so pleasant.
Right. please bestow the light of intelligence on all beings everywhere. Homage to Saraswati. So who is Saraswati? Why would he be paying homage to Saraswati? Anyone?
Wisdom.
And wisdom, what is Saraswati?
Well, she's like the goddess of the arts and there's like expression and things. I don't remember all of it.
So what's the note? Anyone? Grant, are you with us? 21, you want to read that?
21.
Short note.
This verse was written by Nipam Rinpoche. Alden mentioned that Saraswati is also the female deities Tara and Prajnaparamita and the great Tibetan yogini Yeshe Sogyal.
She's got a lot going on.
I know that all germs are the same. But this seems to happen a lot with the female ones. It's like, oh, and she's also that one. And
she's Yeshayahu Sogyo. They're all Yeshayahu Sogyo.
Women are all the same.
Yeah, it's just like...
Oh.
Yeah, it's just like this country.
Oh.
Yeah, it could be a little bit of a...
Yeah. Chauvinistic thing. Yeah,
so
men
don't worry, you don't need to remember.
All sorts of options. The women are all the same.
Sorry.
And their role is always the same, just wisdom, just understanding emptiness. And men get to do all the work, all the fun stuff, right?
Yeah, all the heavy lifting.
But the Tara gets to do like 21 different things.
That's true,
right?
That's
there's
true.
A lot of
different colors, different
yeah.
flavors. Okay. Anyway, back to the 21st century here. With 100,000 melodious words of the noble Dharma, you beautify a garden of lotus and full bloom, it fills with all the Buddhas. Saraswati, graceful swan, glowing with the luster of moonlight, playfully cruise at this time through the lake in my mind. They don't have a note on swan, but swan, is that an odd epithet? Why swan? And you think about that, like Proust or something. What are they thinking? Anyway, the homage to the Vidyadharas of the three lineages. Anyone know the three lineages? The Galuk, the Kagyu, the Nyingma,
and the sign and the thought and the.
So I'm thinking of you, I'm sending you a card, and...
I'm talking to you?
I'm calling you.
Oh, okay.
So what are the three lineages? What are
long distance?
What are they generally? Three lineages of what? Say again?
Three ways of teaching.
Three ways of teaching, of transmitting enlightened mind. Three ways of transmitting enlightened mind. Mind lineage, no words, just... speech, or no, sign lineage, just like
symbolic
lineage.
Creating situations.
What are some other signs? Environments, right?
Forms,
colors, shapes, images, practices, signs. Yeah, practices give you the key, right? The sign, and then speech. Your whispered teaching. Seat syllables, very much signs, eh?
And then what's the last one actually called?
Ear whispered teachings, ear whispered lineage.
So that's literal.
Yeah. Well, that's.
Word
lineage. Literal. Literature. Let's see, with one gulp of discernment. You retained in the belly of your intelligence 100,000 streams of the definitive and secret three sections of the tantras. Jeez, what are those? I even read this. Dzogchen, I see. Mind, space, and instruction. Parts of the Dzogchen tantras. Which you disgorged, like the learned one, Agastya, as excellent explanations having eight qualities. Rather graphic. I praise you hundreds of times, genuine masters of the awareness of the past. The homage to Longchenpa, teaching the Buddha like the realm of the 33 gods. Let's see, 20, is it 18?
Gods?
How many?
Not 18, we're already...
The 33 is part of the desire realm gods, is the 33. Where many non-sectarian learned authors assemble, like the vassal kings pay homage to Indra. In their center, like Indra, you sit majestically on the supreme Yana, Dzogchen, which is like Sasong, the royal elephant. So now elephants are like good. Now we get the royal elephant. And from there you survey all phenomena with your thousand shining eyes. What I miss?
Sasam in Tibetan, it says, which means protector of the earth.
Protector of the earth, Sasam. Yeah. That sounds familiar.
Because it was a Sawa.
Yeah.
Normally Sakyam is, so that's, yeah, that's what I mentioned. Sawa. It's kind of interesting, different.
That's like Kasam. Do you know the word Kasam? The Sung, command. The Sung there, command protector. It's the same here, Sasam.
Yeah.
where Sawang is earth lord, and Sakyong is earth ruler, earth mono.
So somehow Sasun is actually
is earth protector.
The
world
elephant.
Is
33 heads.
Oh my God.
33-headed elephant.
And it
for the
central
33 one. Gods, right?
And the 32 vassal kings sit on the surrounding heads.
An odd number. That's, yeah, that's good. Nice.
It's right up there.
And from there you survey all phenomena with your thousand shining eyes, openly brandishing your thousand-pronged vajra of explanation, debate, and composition, which are the three activities that all pundits are supposed to do. You're crowned with the jewels of many scriptures. Supremely learned Lord Longchenpa, as renowned as Indra, never before has there been someone like you. Please victoriously crown the top of my head. You'll notice that Longchenpa got three verses, four verses, versus other people's one. Oh my God. The homage to Jamgun Mipham, your arrogant and vicious opponents, like a thousand elephants, are overpowered.
So elephants are back.
Again, elephants are back as bad guys. Even without study or contemplation, by your laughing roar of reasoning, oh lion of speech, which is a common way of referring to Mipham, Mipham Chokle Namgyal may you be victorious. The homage to the root teacher. With a sharp vajra weapon of scripture and reasoning, you overpower your opponents who resemble arrogant, jealous gods. Gracious teacher who kindly helps me see the excellent, genuine path. Like the king of the king, of the gods, may you be ever victorious. And so this is the author's root teacher, who is who?
It says that Mipham, the verse was written by Mipham, and it uses the metaphor of the teacher as Indra, holding the scepter of a thousand-pronged vajra.
Okay, interesting. So just generally to the root teacher, the root guru in general. And who's the author, by the way? Anyone?
The author of this book?
Yeah.
I mean, is Ken
Paulden,
I mean, sure,
Paulden Chera,
right?
Paulden
Chera,
right?
Kenpo brother.
Yeah, everybody got that. and it's a commentary on a text written by... Okay. Just checking. Sometimes those things get lost, you know.
Keep track of it.
These verses of homage are offered like the welcoming gesture strewn in fresh white lotus petals in the root Manjushri Tantra. The letter A, great nature itself, holds the teaching of the teacher in the highest esteem. A letter holds the teacher. Okay. Qualities of Jamgun Mipham. Before going further, I want to discuss Mipham Rinpoche, the author of the root text, who was predicted in several Terma scriptures. First, there's a prediction of him in a Terma discovered by Drodol Songnak Lingpa, the emanation of Nupchen, who was a disciple of Guru Padmasambhava, one of the 25 big ones way back, named Mipham, will come forth as an especially powerful lord of mind Terma. Another prediction of Mipham Rinpoche comes from the Terma discovered by Terchen Trokchung Dujum Trolo Tsal. Mipham Gyatso will turn back the flood of invading armies, conquer the tenet systems of mistaken views, and make the Vajrayana teachings shine brilliantly like the sun. There are other predictions of Mipham Rinpoche, particularly in the Vajra predictions of the King of Sages, Buddha Shakyamuni, as well as the Vajra predictions of Bhogyan Padmakara, the second Buddha of our time. They greatly praise Mipham as the very embodiment of the wisdom of all the Buddhas, or in other words, as Jetsun Manjushri, the lion of speech, appearing in the form of a spiritual friend. So he was considered to be an emanation of Manjushri. Second Buddha, who's another great guy that was considered to be the second Buddha?
Nagarjuna.
So they're going to have to fight that one out between them. Being a master of the eight great treasures of confidence, although Nagarjuna lived at like, he was born in like 150 and he lived for 600 years, right? So that would take him to the time of Padmasambhava, so maybe he and Padmasambhava are the same person.
Is that actually...
No, I totally made that up. being a master of the eight great treasures of confidence and the four right discriminations. What are the four right discriminations? Anyone?
Yeah.
What are we on, 42?
Yes.
42.
Mm-hmm. four right distributions are right distribution of the meaning, of the dharma, of the explanation of words, and of the confidence to teach. For a lengthy discussion of these, see Nipam 2012.
Okay. It's the last volume of his Gateway to Knowledge book. His famous Gateway to Knowledge has a long description of these four. And let's see, where the heck were we? Mipham Rinpoche wrote outstanding commentaries on the countless entrances to the common and uncommon scriptures, particularly the profound and vast intentions of the sutras and tantras, which had been perfectly expounded by the Buddha. Jamgon Mipham showed especially sharp intelligence in that his analyses did not depend on what other scholars had said. It's an interesting statement, and I've seen this before, where they say that he was totally original in his explanations, whereas most other teachers, like ordinary, your run-of-the-mill teachers or scholars or authors, will pretty much base their commentaries on the commentaries of other people, and it just sort of goes on and on, this system of plagiarism that basically runs throughout Tibet and all of Buddhism. But he's distinguished by being more original.
Was he a Tertian also or not?
I've never seen anything claiming that he was.
Just his buddy, the one that was the main Tertian at the time, the
hero, was Chokchur Lingpa,
yeah.
Khyentse Wangpo, and Kongchul, Jamgon Kongchul.
Uh-huh.
And Khyentse and Chokchur Lingpa were the two Tertians from that group. Three Musketeers. See, Jamgon Mipham showed especially sharp intelligence in his analyses. I already read that, sorry.
So it was maybe more from the sense of being, that sense of him being Manjushri, that he just had the confidence of being able to just say, you know, originally, you know, his own thing and
yeah.
Not feel that he needed to rely on anything
right.
else.
He was truly inseparable from Jetsun Manju Gosha, which is a form of Manjushri, in the sense that he was a siddha as well as a scholar. He was enlightened and also scholarly. He was all-knowing about the definitive meaning. He was the Jetsun Lama, whose compassion was totally beyond reference points. It is with the utmost reverence that I repeat his name renowned throughout the three levels of the world, which is a different scheme from the three realms, and is one somebody may have encountered in various development stage practices that we do. What does he say?
He refers to the plains above the earth where the gods dwell, the earth where the humans dwell, and below the earth where the nagas dwell.
Yep. Pretty clear. Pretty well known. Mipham Jamyang Namgyel Gyatso or Jampel Gyepe Dorje. So these guys have numerous names, different names. It was his voice that bestowed the teachings and the sword of wisdom that ascertains reality. Now to begin explaining the root text, there are three parts. The title. I love the way they divide things up. The title, the exposition of the subject matter, and the conclusion. Totally different than Westerners. The title, okay. The explanation of the title, the title of Wisdom that Ascertains Reality, corresponds to the words of Nupchen Sanjay Yeshe in the Lamp of the Eye of Meditation, his text elucidating the key points of meditation, where he says, one gains certainty about reality from the wisdom of contemplation, which employs examples, arguments, and reasoning to become decisive. Reality is discovered by comprehending and analyzing with discerning wisdom.
One thing that the note on Nupchen Sanjay Yeshe is interesting in that, A, he was one of the 25 disciples of Padmasambhava, but also because both Jamgon Mipham and Kenshin Palden Shurab are considered emanations of that guy. That's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So he's basically talking about himself with great reverence.
Yeah.
Or another person who was manifesting the same.
Yeah. But what's also interesting about that is people don't say that Paul Dinsherup was an emanation of Manjushri. even though they were both an emanation of the same God.
Yeah, it is interesting.
A very fluid system. It's no contradiction for the Tibetans. It's, yeah, sure, that's. Nupchen had many emanations. Mipom was one, and Kimchen, mm-hmm. Paulincher was one. Anyway, so he says this. Paulincher's claiming that Mipom's text is a commentary on this little stanza. And I find the interesting thing about this stanza for me was that it points out that, okay, we have the wisdom of contemplation. What is the wisdom of contemplation? What is the scheme is the wisdom of contemplation part of?
Hearing, contemplating, and meditating.
Hearing, contemplating, and meditating, right? The three what?
Disciplines? No.
Three skills.
Three prajnas. The three prajnas, hearing, contemplating, and meditating. So contemplating is said to be perfected or brought to completion, so to speak, through this whole use of valid cognition, syllogism, proofs, and so forth. He says that by which employs examples, arguments, and reasonings in order to become decisive. So basically, the scheme of the three prajnas in accessing the Dharma is first you hear the teachings, and then you challenge the teachings with reasoning and valid, you know, all this stuff that we're learning, syllogisms and so forth. That's contemplation. That's what he's saying.
He's
Nupchen Sanje Yeshe. You can't argue with him. No, you should argue with everybody and use examples and reasoning. And then based upon that, you identify the true meaning, which at that point is what? Is of the types, different types of cognition. What type of cognition is
valid?
It? No, it's a valid cognition. What type of valid cognition is it?
Inferential,
right? And then you bring that into meditation practice, where hopefully over time it becomes a
direct valid
cognition, non-conceptual.
Always about what Trump Rinpoche. I thought Trump Rinpoche didn't do that much analyzing, at least teaching us to do that. It was more like contemplation was just resting your mind on a sentence or a teaching and let the true meaning arise from that, rather than figuring it out.
So, was that the only teaching he gave?
Who?
Rinpoche.
Well, he so de-emphasizes the analytical approach.
Oh, but let's talk about this a second. This is an interesting question. This gentleman's implying that hearing of contemplation happens outside of meditation.
Right.
With reasoning and arguments and examples, right? So what did? So what you describe, can you describe what Rinpoche had us do again? Simply rest your mind.
Like he gives a talk, so we hear it. And then I remember in old seminary days, like in the discussion groups or whatever, somebody would say, well, what here he said such and such, let's contemplate that. It was more like resting your mind on that rather than thinking about it or analyzing it and letting some essence come out of that rather than the literal meaning of it. So I remember an example once. It was like when he said, simply see red as red. And it was like, okay, well, you see it as red, but then when you actually contemplate, what does that really mean? And something else arises.
But the contemplation is a process of asking questions. So in my experience of his teaching and what we went through with him, He gave vast amount of teachings, huge amount of teachings, lists and descriptions. And then when we would have, as John said, after the talk the next day, like at seminary, you would have discussion group and you would sometimes listen to the talk and then discuss it again. And the idea in discussion groups was really to like question the material and try to understand it And what is he saying there? And in particular, we used a certain scheme. He encouraged us to use a scheme in order to understand his talks. Anybody?
Ground path fruition.
Yeah, ground path and fruition, yeah. And so there's three parts, ground, path, and fruition. And in some way, that's my interpretation was he was having us go through some level of reasoning and development of intellectual understanding of the material, inferential valid cognition of the material, by giving us all these teachings and having us try to understand them and then pushing us to like think about them and talk about them and almost, you know, debate about them, not in a formal way, but like really discuss them and put each other on the spot and challenge, you know, in a friendly way. There was never any, you know, debate form to it. But and it was very different from then coming to meditation. But it was, compared to other Tibetan teachers and community sanghas, there was so much more study. Not compared to the monastic universities, but all of the other ones, they just had people do pujas all day long, right? Chant in Tibetan, prayers, and then you would practice. And practice also was different, but he just had so much, he really, you know, pushed our minds to really think about things and understand spiritual materialism and theism and all this stuff. I don't know.
I just never thought of it as particularly analytical, like logical analysis, but more getting at what is the essence of what he's saying here? What is the essence?
But it was also, how do you apply it? It was also how do you apply it
right.
To daily life, or to how does it relate to this dharma, or how does it relate to that mm-hmm. teaching? You know, so I think it went way beyond just an intuitive flash.
Well, I'm not saying a flash, but I thought it was more about getting to the wisdom. The true meaning was more about the wisdom of it rather than just some analytical understanding of what these four things are. Literally, but that's just my own experience. That's why I was so taken, because it wasn't just learning stuff, it was getting at the essence of it, what's under it all.
I think this is, for me, this is the same.
Okay.
This whole use of reasoning and so forth is to get to the essence of it. But it's obviously way more formulistic and structured and so forth. But, reality is then discovered by comprehending and analyzing with discerning wisdom. Not quite sure if is that the third wisdom?
No.
That's still a further gloss on the second wisdom, isn't it?
That sounds like
right?
Yeah.
So reality or the essence is discovered by comprehending and analyzing. Anyway, the subject matter of this lamp of the eye of meditation, which was a text by who? Okay. Is the Buddha's teaching, just make sure you're all with me. The sutras and tantras, along with their commentaries, whose meanings are both profound and vast. And what does profound refer to?
Ultimate truth.
The absolute and ultimate and vast. The profound wisdom of fully everything else.
There's
no else, just everything. The profound wisdom of fully ascertaining reality comes from properly using correct, unmistaken reasoning. So he's explaining the quote, right? The profound wisdom of fully understanding reality, the last line of the quote, comes from properly using correct, unmistaken reasoning that accords with the nature of things. Essence, right? The nature of things. Since this kind of correct reasoning instantly cuts through the three nets of not understanding, misunderstanding, and doubt, it is like a sword. So last time I had described like a range of different ways that we approach understanding our world, ranging from at one extreme, not understanding, incorrect understanding, and doubt, and then correct assumption, and then inference, valid inference, and then direct cognition. And we'll go through and hand a little chart that shows that. Anyway, therefore, the sword of wisdom that ascertains reality is said to be a title that connects the metaphor with the meaning. The metaphor with the meaning. What does that mean? Anyone? The metaphor with the meaning. What is the metaphor?
Sort of wisdom.
Yeah, right. What's the meaning?
What ascertains reality?
You want the note?
It doesn't say.
It says some titles show the meaning, or the main words, or a metaphor, or the choice of teaching, or the name of the person who requested it. So any number of different facets. So in this case, they're saying that this one is using the metaphor
okay.
to show the meaning.
So here it refers to the metaphor in the last sentence, that correct reasoning is like a sword.
Yeah.
And the meaning is that reasoning cuts through incorrect attempts to understand. Titles are said to be necessary in order to eliminate confusion when ordering books on Amazon. The Sutra of the Descent of Lhanka states, if one does not apply names, everything in the world will be confused. Therefore, to clear away confusion, the Buddha designated things with names. That's an odd little quote, isn't it?
First time I've ever heard that.
You got to give everything a name.
Right?
Labeling. All labeling. Okay, the validity of the teachings and the teacher. The Sword of Wisdom has three sections. The start of the composition makes it... So, the Sword of Wisdom, the body of the text, which was part two of the three parts, has three sections. The start of the composition makes it good in the beginning, the main part makes it good in the middle, and the conclusion makes it good at the end. Everything's got to fit together, right? What else, what is he talking about here, good in the beginning, middle, and end? What is famous for being good in the beginning, middle, and end?
The Dharma.
The Dharma. The ice cream, huh? The beginning section includes a verse of homage, followed by a verse stating the author's purpose. This philosophy is unmistaken. All errors have been eliminated. The mind is free from doubts about three points. I pay homage to Manjushri, the treasure of wisdom. The meaning of the word philosophy. The word philosophy is drawn from the Sanskrit word siddhanta. Philosophy is connected with ultimate reality, refers to a system of assertions that are made with certainty because they come from investigating, analyzing through scripture and reasoning. This is what we call a system of tenets. It reaches a final conclusion for which nothing further need be posited. Philosophy, which is the translator's translation for this term in Sanskrit, siddhanta, which normally is translated as tenets, or system. Let's see. Philosophy is unmistaken if it accords with the true nature of things, and mistaken if it cannot be proven to accord with the way things are. There are two basic types of philosophical systems, ours and theirs. Worldly and transcendent. In relation to these two types of philosophy, Ugyen, second Buddha, says in his Garland of Views, famous text by Padmasambhava, going through the views of the different stages of the nine levels, the nine yanas. In this world, there are countless mistaken views, but they can be summarized into four main ones. Materialism, we all know that. Hedonism, we've heard of that. Fundamentalism, we've seen that on TV every night, unfortunately. And extremism. The note says, let's see, materialists are flat ones. Whose interests are confined to the surface of life, like having enough food and a nice place to live, like having internet and delivery service. Hedonists, which literally means those who throw far away, they think there is no past or future karma and are only interested in present enjoyment. Fundamentalists, who depend on the limits or the structures, rules, they are narrow-minded and rigid about following rules because they fear punishment by a god. And then there's extremists who stay at the edge. Their tenet systems are based on the extreme views of externalism and nihilism.
Isn't hedonists a little bit nihilistic too?
They certainly can be. They can mix. You can be more than one. And there are two paths that transcend the world, the vehicle of characteristics and the Vajra vehicle. What is the vehicle of characteristics?
Sutrayana
is another term for it. But why is it called that? Vehicle of characteristics.
Because it relies on the sutras?
That's why it's called characteristics? Why is the Sutrayana called the vehicle of characteristics? What's another term for
causal?
Causal yana.
Causal and that's not quite.
Causes are certainly types of characteristics. Are there other types of characteristics? So there's an implication, or the general implication is that that there's the causal yana. And the resultant yana, sutrayana, and vajrayana. But then also there's another gloss on by calling them the vehicle of characteristics, they're saying that the sutrayana, the causal yana, is dependent upon characteristics in the sense of science and logical reasoning, where the sutrayana, the paths incorporated in sutrayana depend on inferential understanding. And the Vajrayana depends on non-inferential, direct, non-conceptual understanding. In the Sutrayana, we look at the Four Noble Truths, cause, effect, the effect of suffering, the cause is the root of suffering, and cessation, and the path. And that has a whole causal, as Chris was saying, network to it. And so we have the three characteristics of the three marks of existence and all that stuff. And so it's all about pointing to the ultimate by use of reasonings, by use of the relative, by use of signs or characteristics. And Vajrayana is all about just experiencing it directly without any conceptual footwork or structure or help. Okay, so the great omniscient, the great translator, rather, Kawa Peltsak, comments in his explanation of the levels of the view. Both the worldly and transcendent views appear from one source, like things made of gold. They can be summarized into 17 views. There's no footnote on that, though. Once you have understood them, then either accept them or leave them behind. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Okay. The validity of the teachings. First, to establish the validity of the teachings, Buddhist philosophy is valid because it hasn't the slightest defect in terms of being mistaken.
Because it's not wrong.
Right.
Is that it's fundamentalism?
Circular, for sure.
This is because the Buddha Bhagavan, the one who taught these tenets, eliminated all errors, including the two obscurations and their seeds and habitual tendencies. Our teacher is called a great being because his vision came from valid, direct perception, and he perfected the qualities of wisdom, compassion, and power, which are generally... are usually considered to be the three qualities of an enlightened one: wisdom, compassion, and power. Normally we hear about wisdom and compassion, but in more detail or more traditional versions, there's also power or strength.
And it's also
meaning, sorry?
Go ahead.
Meaning the ability to do what? The power being?
Know everything.
That would be wisdom.
To help all beings.
Power to help beings, yeah.
That's why you're funny.
Yes, the three bodhisattvas, right?
Yeah.
Right, right. So, who were the other two bodhisattvas?
Tree for wisdom, compassion, and power.
Right. So those are the three so-called, what are they? Celestial bodhisattvas or something. Right? Let's see. However, Buddhist philosophy is proven to be a pure and valid scriptural teaching through the three types of investigation. Okay, here we go. We're going to review our whole little scheme of the pramana and valid cognition. So who's going to be my reader from the notes? Any volunteers? Mary Beth?
Okay.
Thank you. Volunteer.
Pick me.
Okay, so what are the three criteria for valid evidence? Three types of investigation is 57. Is that right? Numbers are so freaking small.
Three types of investigation, which are also known as the three types of valid cognition, are direct perception for manifest phenomena, inference for hidden phenomena, and valid scriptures for very hidden phenomena.
Hmm. Okay, so there's three types there. Generally, we whittle them down into two types that are relevant for us, but the third one, valid scriptures, is interesting. Okay, and through reasoning that fulfills the three criteria for valid evidence, note 58.
The three criteria for valid evidence are the presence of the reason in the subject of debate, the positive pervasion, and the counter pervasion.
Okay, so those are, I think we called them last week, the three modes of a valid syllogism that make your logic ironclad. And then, in relation to the three aspects of a valid inference.
The three aspects of a valid inference are inference based on conventional usage, inference based on the power of facts, and inference based on trust.
Okay, now I'm going to give you my slant is that the translator didn't fully present this section of the sentence correctly. Because, read those three again.
Inference based on conventional usage, based on the power of facts, and based on trust.
Okay, so those are three types of inference, or three avenues of developing inference. The first one, based on conventional usage, such as, like, we call this a table. That's like, we all agree on that. That doesn't have a lot of weight when we're talking about, like, how do you know, what's the source of suffering, and how do you achieve cessation, right? Common parlance is not that reliable. How about the third one? What was the third one?
Trust.
So, like, you know, how trustworthy, how far will that get you? You know, trusting other people or trusting what people tell. They told me, you know, she said that's what it was, so. She said she loved me.
Never trust.
Yeah. So the only one of those three that is worth focusing on is the middle one. What is it called?
Power of facts.
Valid inference based on the power of fact. Authentic facts, right?
So what was it exactly then that you thought the translator was?
Well, the translator said in relation to the three aspects of a valid inference, as if those three are parts of a valid inference.
Mm-hmm.
That's not correct. Those are three avenues towards inference. Those are three options or types of possible valid inference, and only the second one is reliable of those. So the whole system of Buddhist valid cognition is based on that second one, on the power of fact. How do we experience fact?
Our senses.
Through our senses, which are what type of cognition?
Direct
valid cognition, right? So inference has to be based on direct cognition. Inferential valid cognition has to be based on direct valid cognition. So you can't draw up logics or reasoning about things that we don't all perceive with our senses. So the information we get from our senses is the basis from which we then develop valid cognitions.
But then in your favorite one about smoke and fire, the smoke is a direct perception. But the other part of it is based on some kind of knowledge of what might produce smoke, but it's not based on a direct valid, I mean, direct
it's
perception.
It's an incorrect inference.
Okay.
Right, because we now know that there's other ways that smoke comes mm-hmm. about. But if it was a valid one, it would be based on valid direct cognition.
And nothing else.
Right, not hearsay, not common parlance, not mm-hmm. scripture.
So what about things like, I'll never perceive a quark or any other subatomic particle, right?
Right, things you can't observe, right?
But because not me, but someone much smarter than me has figured them out, like I can watch TV now, right? Like reliably.
Yeah.
Like in a completely not bullshitty way, I can turn on my television.
Yeah, you turn on your computer, write email to somebody else and they read it and respond. It's like, whoa. So how do you get from quarks to that experience of watching TV? Did quarks, which you can't see, you know, in other words, subatomic particles are used for functional purposes. So how do we get from, how do we approach subatomic particles that we can't see with our eyes or hear or feel? How do we know they exist?
They're extensions of our mechanism of perception.
Yeah, microscopic telescopes or whatever.
Little enough, we know they're there.
Yeah, so
it's like you didn't see it, but somebody else did through this thing. Is that what you're saying, basically?
Either we create ways of seeing them with our eyes, or we create ways of knowing that they're there because we see the effect. You know, which is also one way that these things happen, is like, you know, we know something's there because it blocks something else, or it moved the trajectory of the beam of light or something.
But still,
right?
Isn't there some inference going on there?
Right, so the presence of that particle then, which you don't perceive directly, is developed by inference, and that inference is based on a direct perception of seeing, of something you can see.
There's some measurable fact.
Right, it all comes back to some experience with the senses.
So that's kind of why science ties in with this fairly well.
Right.
Science tends to rely on that same set of observable phenomena. So then, I'm sorry, but the other, one of your other favorite examples is the one about, I forgot what it is, but we say something is compounded or something like that. What is it, like a sound is, what is that, you know, one of your other favorite examples?
Sound is impermanent because it's produced.
Because it's produced. Sound is impermanent because it's produced. So is that one considered valid?
Yes.
Sound is impermanent because it's produced. So is every part of that one also directly observable in our perceptions? Sorry, I'm being difficult, but you said it, so I'm trying to make sense of the ones that we've used a lot.
Yeah, well, trace it back. You know, start with examples.
So that's a sound, we heard it, and I guess we saw that it was produced by some kind of phenomenon, although sometimes we may hear a sound but we don't know where it came from. But so those parts are observable, and then the I guess since it's not still happening, we know it's impermanent, or we're saying it's impermanent, but that association of because it is produced. Is that what we said, right? Okay, I don't know, I guess it's all the parts.
So
basically just those two parts have to be observable, is that right? Just the what do we call that first thing?
The probandum,
yeah.
Or the subject?
The sound, the subject.
The subject.
So the subject has to be observable, and the reason has to be observable. Is that it has to be direct. Those two have to be direct.
Well,
that
syllogism is an inference about a class of phenomena,
mm-hmm.
right? And that inference then is built up from observation or experience with individual phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important to appreciate, right? Because that's the sort of large generalization built upon the experience of specifics. So you'd have to go through examples of specifics and see, for one, do they hold true? And then in what sense do they build up then to the class? And then you know, sort of go through a process of saying, what is the class of all produced phenomena? And, you know, what do we mean by produced phenomena? And so on and so forth. But, you know, that whole process of what we just talked about will be what we talk about for, like, the whole book, at least two-thirds of the book. So, but that's a really good question. And then another part of it is that our direct valid cognition through our senses is not always accurate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so there's also a little bit of a sense of, like, there's consensus. Like, what color is that? Right? Colors, people, some people perceive colors differently, right?
But isn't that a problem with naming rather than a problem of perception?
Yes.
Like, it's a blurry line between what's red and what's orange, and I call it onion. No one ever really drew the line very well, so we get mixed up, but we're perceiving the same thing. It's not the perception that's flawed.
Right. But it's also a blurry line, as you use it metaphorically as well as literally, between naming and signs or characteristics. You know, the whole range of, like, from way that we identify phenomena as being different from others. One way is naming, one way is perception, and those are not actually, like, dramatically different realms, but are in some sense a continuum. And then there's the whole thing where
could you give an example of what you meant by that?
No, I don't know if I could drum up one. I think we have to go further to help me figure out how to support what I just blabbed about. But the other thing, yeah, but these are interesting points to, like, think about and come back to, you know, right? And then the other thing to remember, so the senses are not always accurate, and there is, so is that purely, like, where do you draw the line type of thing?
Or you what?
Where do you draw the line type of thing? You know, where does orange become red, as the example that Chris used? And then how does that differ from, how does that impact, how does that relate to the scheme of there being conventional valid cognition and ultimate valid cognition? Which is something that Meepong touches upon, that I haven't seen anyone else do that. All the other ones, all they do, they're really just all talking about conventional valid cognition, and he, I'm sure it's probably not just him, probably others, but
is that distinction of conventional and ultimate is different than the inferential and direct?
Yeah.
So are conventional and ultimate both subsets of direct, or what is there a relationship in some way between those?
That's a good question. I'm a little weak at the moment on ultimate valid cognition. I think it's more like conventional has inferential and direct, and ultimate probably has just direct valid cognition.
That's what you said last week.
Did I?
No.
Okay, it must be true.
And yogic?
Yogic valid cognition is ultimate valid cognition is basically based upon yogic direct valid cognition.
So that's what makes the distinction.
That when direct valid cognition becomes yogic, then it's ultimate.
Okay.
Something
that's
like that.
So that sounds like that.
But isn't there inferential ultimate?
No.
But I mean, like when we do Madhyamaka, I mean, we're not directly yogically perceiving emptiness, but we're talking about it in a way that is hopefully valid.
Right? Yeah. So that's inferential valid cognition.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Inferential ultimate cognition.
Well, it's about the ultimate.
It's not, but it's in and of itself, it's not.
It doesn't
ultimate.
Get you all the way there. It only gets you 99%.
It's what helps you approach it.
Yeah.
You're using the relative to approach the ultimate.
Because until you get to direct, you're not really at ultimate.
Right.
And then according to what you were just saying, then you need it to be yogic direct to be totally ultimate.
Right. But there's also this scheme of dividing the two truths into the relative truth, into correct and incorrect, and the ultimate into what they call quantifiable and unquantifiable. And the quantifiable is that ultimate which is ascertained through reasoning. And they admit that that type of ultimate is not the true ultimate. And yet they call it the ultimate. But anyway, I think it may come up here because we're about to go into the two truths. Let's see. These lead to doubtless certainty, the essence of intelligence, which is Manjushri, the great treasure of wisdom. Alternatively, one can say that profound intelligence comes from the blessings of Manjushri. Either way, respectful homage is paid with body, speech, and mind to Manjushri as the treasure of wisdom. This verse of homage shows the validity of the teachings primarily by using the reasoning of causal efficacy, one of the four types of reasonings. And you'll see that we use this phrase, type of reasoning, there's a number of different schemes of types of reasonings. So at some point we got to come up with different terms for type of reasoning, like levels or something, because they're not all the same. To formulate this as a syllogism, the Buddhist teachings are unmistaken because they were taught by the Buddha, who's eliminated all errors. The first criterion of a valid proof, the presence of the reason in the subject, is that Buddhist philosophy was indeed taught by the Buddha. The Buddhist teachings are unmistaken because they were taught by the Buddha. So the subject is the Buddhist teachings, and the probandum is that they're unmistaken, and the reason is because they were taught by the Buddha. And he's saying, by definition, the Buddhist philosophy was indeed taught by the Buddha. The second criterion of valid proof of positive pervasion is that if these teachings are by the Buddha, then they are definitively unmistaken. So that's one way. If they're Buddhist teachings, they have to be unmistaken. And the third criterion of a valid proof, the counter-pervasion, is that if the teachings are unmistaken, are mistaken, then they could not be Buddhist teachings. These constitute the logical proof. Now you'll see right away that these sort of logics only make sense within after you've agreed on certain assumptions with your colleagues or opponents.
Yeah, because otherwise it's sort of like it's true because God said it was that way.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I just got the jitters when I read that because, like, well, wait a minute now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
These are true just because the Buddha said them. That's not what he actually said.
Yeah, no, it isn't.
So
what did he say? He said to test them,
yeah.
to not accept
right.
them just because he said it, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, this whole thing is a really odd sort of thing,
and
we'll have to reject it because.
And is this right. one that's based on scriptural authority?
Yeah. What kind of inference is this, or
yeah,
is this common usage or fact or scriptures? This is scriptures, right? Once one has eliminated all errors of their two obscurations, visual patterns, and ultimate wisdom and love arise. Once one has ultimate wisdom, one is capable of teaching an unmistaken path. The motivation to teach is an unmistaken path depends on compassion. So it is said that great compassion is the extraordinary cause of attaining Buddhahood. Dharmakirti, the practice is to become accustomed to compassion. That's an interesting way of looking at practice. In order to overcome suffering, compassion at once actualized the skillful means to do so. Chandrakirti's loving kindness is said to be the seed of the abundant harvest of the victorious ones. It's like the water that caused the seed to develop. And like the ripening that is enjoyed for a long time, therefore from the outset I praise compassion. That's the beginning of his Madhyamaka avatar. The ornament of the Mahayana Sutras states that compassion gives rise to patience, reflection, and aspiration. And it causes sentient beings to fully mature and begins at the root and ends at the supreme fruit. This is the great tree of compassion. Compassion is the root, patience is the trunk. Isn't that interesting? Patience is the trunk of the path. Compassion is the root, then we have patience. Overcoming aggression is patience, right? Reflection on actions that benefit others are the branches. That's reflection. Or aspiring, that's the next one. Aspirations are the foliage. Good births are the flowers. And bringing sentient beings to maturity is the fruit. This is the tree of compassion. Talk to the enlightenment of Roshana states, O Lord of Seekers, because the timeless awareness of the wisdom of omniscience is rooted in compassion, it results from bodhicitta and is the perfection of skillful means. The Buddha Bhagavan fulfilled his own aim through perfecting the qualities of relinquishment and realization. Those two aspects, relinquishing hindrances and realization.
Is that the same pronunciation or is it different?
It is. It's abandonment. Abandoning and developing. And to fulfill the aims of others, he perfected the qualities of wisdom, love, and power.
Is that actually like the Sanjay thing?
Yeah. These qualities are the causes for establishing him as an unfailing, authentic, great being. So the logic here is not totally ironclad, but if students practice just the Buddha Tao, whichever aspects of the Noble Dharma fit their individual styles, compassion, capacities and intentions, they will attain the corresponding results of the higher realms and liberation. This is how Buddhist philosophy is established, is unmistaken. So we're saying that if you practice the Buddhist teachings, you attain the result of the Buddha, the result that you're supposed to achieve. And that's what makes them valid, is that
so,
they work.
So that's actually going beyond it being scriptural,
right,
into where it could be experiential.
Right, using what sort of logic? Inferential logic using what sort of evidence? What type of evidence? Causality, functioning, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you do this, then this happens, and therefore.
Right, yeah. You can test it out because you can do it and see that it happens.
Yeah.
Or you can observe it in others.
Yeah. Hear about it, read about it.
Right.
A great number of supporting scriptures can be cited. Having become omniscient, they turn the wheel of Dharma. If one is not attained, then one cannot turn the wheel of Dharma. And a Tathagata is someone with realization. Because of their omniscience, the Buddhas who have all the signs of full enlightenment give a variety of teachings. And Nagarjuna says, you alone clarify phenomena, detect phenomena. No one is your equal. I pay homage to the Lama, who's superior. It's an interesting quote from Nagarjuna talking about a Lama. A Sangha in this text is definitely free from all obscurations. Your wisdom accomplishes all phenomena. Buddha, you outshine the entire world. I pay homage to you. Fully liberated, so I'll skip all the other ones and come down to scriptural support for the validity of the teachings on the next page. Many Indian Buddhist masters have commented on the validity of the teachings, and then he gives a whole bunch of different quotes. And then on the right-hand side of page 31, is it in the middle? As for the six faults, and the three virtues, let's skip that too. This is just more stuff. How about let's go to the validity of the teacher on 33. The second line of the root verse establishes the validity of the teacher. Having analyzed and established Buddha's philosophy as the unmistaken and valid scriptural teachings of the Noble Dharma, one goes on to therefore establish the teacher, the Buddha Bhagavan, as the one who has completely eliminated all mistakes and ignorance. He is a great being whose valid cognition knows and sees all phenomena without obscurations through direct perception. Valid teachings are dependent on a valid teacher. The cause for becoming a valid teacher is the perfect intention of wanting to benefit beings. The perfect activity of teaching leads to the perfect effect, becoming a sugata for one's own sake and a protector for the sake of others. So it starts with the perfect intention, wanting to benefit others, and leads to enlightenment before you know it. Let's see. The scriptural support for the validity of the teacher, Dignaga, says, I pay homage to the valid great being who wishes to be a benefit and is the teacher, a sugata, a protector. And the commentary to this, Dignaga says, sorry, let's skip this guy. Okay, so using reasoning to establish validity on the next page, 35. Going on to the third line, by using the three types of investigation which we had before, two points have been established. First, that the teachings are a pure, clear, and incomparable entrance to complete liberation. Second, that the teacher, the Buddha, is an incomparable, valid, great being on the basis of his perfect intention, activity, and result. And the third point is that the previous two points are established through reasoning. By using the reasoning of a valid proof in which the three criteria for valid evidence are complete, along with the three aspects of valid inference, these points can be established without doubt. We went through all these little threes. To phrase this as a syllogism, the teacher, the Buddha, is a valid great being because his teachings are valid scriptures. A similar example is a genuine great sage. So this syllogism has an example at the end. The first criterion of proof, the present of the reasons in the subject, is fulfilled because the philosophy of the valid scriptures is established as the words of our teacher, the Buddha. The second, the positive pervasion, is because if the scriptural teachings are valid, then they're definitely taught by a valid great being, which is the Buddha. And the third is the counter. If the teacher is not a valid great being, then the teachings certainly will not be valid. By using reasoning based on the three types of valid cognition, direct perception, inference, and valid scriptures, concerning the Buddha's teachings and the high sort of devotion, unfailing confidence certainly will arise in one's mind. This kind of devotion is the essence of the ultimate way of taking refuge and making supplications. It's the root of the path of liberation, and so forth. So let's skip these. But basically, this very sort of fundamentalistic formulation of faith and devotion to the Buddha as being the valid teacher and the valid source of blessings, valid source of valid teachings, remains like this question, this sort of statement that on one level seems just like fundamentalism, just like something that we would question and reject as being completely accepted as valid and without question, without argument. And so as we go through this, we need to sort of we need to understand the whole system, and then I think come back to this statement and see in what way it might make sense from a logical reasoning point of view. Let's see, talks a lot about Manjushri and how great Manjushri is, and his promise to compose the text. And then the two truths, briefly. In three parts, the two truths on 3.9. The two truths which are the topic to be comprehended, the two types of reasoning which are what does the comprehending, and the result of comprehension. First, for the two truths, the root text says, the Dharma taught by the Buddha is completely based on these two truths, the worldly relative and the supreme absolute. The perfect Buddhas gave a multitude of teachings which are like 84,000 entrances to the Dharma. They can be summed up in two truths. What are the two truths? They are the relative of worldly beings and the absolute that transcends the world. worldly beings are known to be their aggregates. The world definitely depends on the aggregates. It follows that the world refers to individuals who designate things on the basis of the aggregates. We need to understand the highest possible realization is the realization of the nature of the two truths, just as it is, where they are. As one progresses through the yanas, one realizes how the two truths become more and more profound, how they more and more profoundly express the way things truly are. Here we'll briefly examine them in five ways. The essence. First, the essence of the relative is the realm of objects conceptualized through the mind and the sense faculties. So it's really the realm of objects conceptualized through the mind and experienced through the sense faculties. The essence of the absolute is the realm of self-knowing, discerning wisdom, free from the intellect and its fabricated extremes. So the objects of the senses are, even though they're experienced through direct valid cognition, they are among the relative. Let's skip the quotes and the definitions. The word relative is illusory appearances with no real essence. However, temporarily, from a diluted perspective, their specific characteristics are unfailingly true. This is relative truth. From a diluted perspective, their specific character. So, from a diluted perspective, specifically characterized phenomena are unfailingly true within the realm of the relative, within their own sort of circular world. Let's see. The two truths, the second quote. The relative obscures what is genuine for a person in relation to a thing. The absolute, on the other hand, is the ultimate goal, and because the path and result are unfailing, it is called truth. The characteristics of the two truths, skipping the two quotes on 41. For the characteristics, the relative truth is characterized by phenomena that are not beyond the realm of the mind and cannot withstand analysis. Is that okay? The relative cannot withstand analysis.
Means when we analyze it, it doesn't hold up.
Doesn't hold up. So, as the Havajra says, being fallible in the objects of the mind, these are the general characteristics of the relative. The absolute is characterized by the true nature that transcends the mind. In the true nature, all concepts are pacified. Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika says it's not known through something other, so it's peace. It's not non-conceptual and not the different objects. Sorry, it is non-conceptual. It is not fabricated through conceptual constructs. These are the characteristics of suchness. Is there a lot of suchness in this room? Okay, the thing that we should all be questioning is the statement that the relative cannot withstand analysis. So if we're saying that the relative is the realm where we apply inferential valid cognition, then what does that mean? Is inferential valid cognition supporting relative phenomena or destroying it?
Both.
Cannot withstand analysis.
There has to be some distinction, right? Between like how much analysis is like okay. The idea being like nothing bottoms out, but we still need to be able to speak relatively. So like how much grounding is required?
Yeah, and thus the scheme of relative analysis and ultimate analysis.
Yeah.
You know, where as you said, how much is enough is relative analysis. And then if you go beyond that, it's ultimate.
Is this where the metaphor of the snake and the rope come in between diluted relative and
correct relative?
Yeah, but then at the ultimate level, it's not a rope anymore. It's empty. It's appearance and emptiness.
Possibly. Possibly a way of describing them. The famous rope trick, right? So then there's classifications of the two truths, further classifications of the relative and ultimate. I'll skip the quote. The relative truth has two categories, the correct and the incorrect. The correct relative is the objects that appears to the mind through the unmistaken six senses. Sixth one being the mental sense, the unmistaken part of the mental sense. And knowledge of the words and terms that follow what worldly people consider true and false. The incorrect relative is what appears to someone with defective sense faculties, like visions of falling hairs. So the first one included, the correct relative includes sense perceptions and knowledge of words and terms that follow what worldly people consider true and false. Worldly, conventional reasoning. Let's see. Although they appear similar, the quote from the two truths, because some of them can perform functions and others cannot perform functions, they're the categories of the correct and incorrect, thus form the categories. These form the categories of the relative. So being able to perform a function is the correct relative, and not able to perform a function, like falling hairs and the shimmering on the desert, mirage, is the incorrect. Not able to perform a function of satisfying thirst. The absolute also has two categories, the expressible absolute, which accords with the ordinary mind, and the inexpressible, which transcends the ordinary mind. Interesting use of ordinary mind. The adornment in the middle way says, since it accords with the ultimate, it is called the absolute. In reality, there is freedom from the hosts of conceptual constructs. In relation to their purpose, the two truths states, those who understand the classification of the two truths are not confused about the words of the Buddha. Since all of them have accumulated merit, they will go to the far shore of perfection. And that's where we stop. The syllabus. Oh, 42, yeah, we did 42, okay. So, this lays out the scheme. Where we have the Buddha is infallible, the Buddha's teachings are infallible, and we have two levels of truth, the relative, which is what we experience, the appearances, some of which are correct, they perform a function, they're functioning, and then incorrect. Oh, and then quickly let's pass these guys out, and we'll go over them next week. You can stare at them. So maybe you can pass that around. There's three sheets. Oh, you have printed them?
Oh, I'm sorry, these are collated?
Yeah.
Sorry.
So one set of three each.
Let's see.
Sure. Share that with your buddies to your left, please. All good? Not to accept this whole statement about the Buddha being valid without it, without there being a valid logical proof of it. So I think we'll go through the text and the whole scheme and then come back to that and challenge it, see if we can get comfortable with that otherwise fundamentalistic type of statement. Comments? Any suggestions? Have a good evening. And dedicate the merit. by this merit can all obtain omniscience, may defeat the enemy wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the regent's wisdom bloom.
May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound brilliant glory.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So now we start going through the different types of reasonings, causality, result, or functional efficacy, nature, and interdependence.
Mm-hmm.